First part of session 100, we get to the first three-digit session. Let's talk here more about the transformation of the mind and also great way. We're talking about archetypical mind. Let's begin. This is the second to last session that you will find in the original material. If you remember, I like to say this all the time that I can, there are four or five main books, depending on how you see the material, four or five main books that are the original material. And then there is the Raw Contact, which I actually have here. It's in two volumes. And if you are watching on YouTube, you can see the whole raw material here. And they're actually working on making a unified book. This unified book is going to be just one big book with everything included, and I think that's a great idea too. I am personally in love with the version of the Raw Contact. I think it's nice to divide it in two. One big book may be too cumbersome to read, but in any case, that's the way in which the Raw Contact has evolved in terms of material readable. Why am I mentioning this? Because in the original books, they got up to session 103, which means that, that doesn't say much. 100 is the second to last session that is in there, because 101 and 2 and the rest after 103 are going to be just personal material. That means that if you consider valuable information that which is in the study of metaphysics, and in this case, the mind itself or the archetypical mind, then we are coming to a close in terms of that material. The rest is just going to be personal material, like I said, and it's going to revolve around the situations that they were living at the time, and there's always something that we can take out of that. So we're going to finish, of course, all sessions here, and that's the purpose of this series. Now here, though, we're going to begin with personal material, as we can expect, and then we're going to move into archetypical mind, transformation, and gray way. Again, this will be the second to last session in which we discuss archetypical mind, and yeah, so let's begin with the first question that I always include, not always, but for a long time I've been doing it. Don says in first question, could you first please give me the condition of the instrument? And Ra says, it is as previously stated, with the exception of the vital energy distortion, which leans more towards strength weakness than the last asking. So vital energy distortions lean more towards strength weakness than the last asking. Does that mean that Carla is getting stronger in terms of her vital energies? Maybe. That's what I get. Sometimes I read it reverse, but I think that's what it is. It's confusing that they use strength weakness. So, well, whatever the case is, we move to the second question. Don says in question two, thank you. The instrument asks if there is some problem with the swirling waters, since she feels very dizzy after each application. Could Ra comment on that, please? And Ra, classic Ra, I missed this from them. They said, yes. In essence, yes, we can comment. So Don says, would Ra please comment in question three? And Ra goes ahead and says, as has been previously noted, the instrument has the propensity for attempting to exceed its limits. If one considers the metaphysical or time-space aspect of an incarnation, this is a fortunate and efficient use of catalysts, as the will is constantly being strengthened. And further, if the limitations are exceeded in the service of others, the polarization is also most efficient. However, we perceive the query to speak to the space-time portion of incarnational experience, and in that framework, Wood again asked the instrument to consider the value of martyrdom. The instrument may examine its range of reactions to the swirling waters. It will discover a correlation between it and other activity. I think this is a long answer, so let's go bit by bit. Yeah, we have more. Well, Oliver made his cameo. It's been a while, so I hope you were able to hear him in the background. It's spring here, so there's people walking in the streets, and of course he doesn't like that. He's a guardian, so he needs to scare out everybody from the house. But all right, this is a useful, I guess, advice for what we do and the extremes that we can get into because of passion, because we have passion. So let's begin with that. The question itself was, why was Carla feeling dizzy after the application of the swirling waters? Now, Carla describes this, especially in this session, that would be in either book 5, this session, or if you go to the Raw Contact, in the lawofone.info. I'm actually a little bummed out by the fact that in these books, the commentary from Carla and Jim is not present. So that's why I like to go to the lawofone.info online. Links in the description if you want to go read straight their commentary. In any case, there you will hear or read Carla talk about this bathtub that they had and where she had to go for this massage in her back and so on. So she describes also an event in which she kind of freaked out and started panicking, went behind the couch after that, and I'm not sure what was happening there. She comments that later Rob would say something, there was a sort of exchange between Don and Carla, a metaphysical exchange where she started feeling Don's sort of dissatisfaction with the world, like she embodied Don's dislike for the world somehow, and it's like she lived for a period of time, minutes maybe, his discomfort, and it was very unsettling. In any case, you can go read that yourself. The point is that she describes how she was getting into this bathtub where she was, you know, getting the massage. And so Ra's going to talk about this, and that's where they're beginning to say, you know, as has been previously noted, Carla, in essence, has that propensity for exceeding her limits. Now, they say that if you consider the metaphysical impact of this, then you can see that her will is being strengthened, right? And if the limitations are exceeded in the service of others, then polarization is also most efficient, meaning that if her will was focused on giving more and more of herself, then metaphysically you're strengthening that capacity, right? Your polarization increases because you're increasing your capacity of being of service. Now, is that the right way to do it? Maybe. Maybe for her. Maybe for others. It doesn't have to be for everybody. So this is where we get the syndrome of, I have to be as loving as Jesus. Well, to be honest, we don't even know how loving Jesus was. That's just what we say about him. And I actually have my own view that Jesus wasn't as loving as he is depicted. I think he was more human than anybody else, or as human as everybody else. And you can see this in the exchanges that he had with some of his disciples, even. So anyhow, we're going on a tangent here. The point is that you don't have to be a specific way, right? But for Carla, this worked. So they talked about the value of being like this in terms of time-space, but they do say, okay, no, we perceive that your question has to do with the space-time portion, so your incarnational experience, her physical body. And they are, again, considering or asking them to consider the value of martyrdom. if she examines her range of reactions to the swirling waters, then she will discover a correlation between it and other activity. My speculation here is that if she would see that maybe she was saying, actually Ross says this, she was trying to maybe massage too much her body because maybe that will help her out in the sessions. In other words, she was doing this because she wanted to have her body energy, her physical energy restored so she can do more sessions. But, you know, if you want to rest and you say, oh, I'm going to sleep for 3 days, you're probably going to do some detriment to your body. However, the will is important there. So you see, metaphysically, the will is being strengthened into saying, like, I am going to sleep for 3 days to recover. But the reflection or the reactivity of the body to sleeping for 3 days is actually going to be, detrimental. So you can see the exchange here between, the benefit of being very dedicated mentally and then the detriment to the body. So you have to find a sort of balance here. Now, I'm going to throw in some of my old knowledge in terms of training, because the body is mentioned here. So, not to bore you with details, but when we design a training program for bodybuilding, there is a clever way to do this, because we know that training, lifting weights and training your body, can go into the extremes of exhaustion, right? That's what we do. We fail lifting weights so we can produce a sort of stimuli to the body, and the body adapts, and that adaptation comes with muscle strength and so on. So that's training in general. We need to exceed a certain threshold so we can get the benefits from it. Now, the vast majority of trainees are what we call overtrained. Overtrained meaning that they exceed constantly their capacity for stimulation, and they start to jeopardize the recover fact or the recover aspect of it. And that recovery, once is hampered, then you begin to have diminishing returns. And so you don't progress, you don't lift more, and you don't get the benefits, obviously, that you're looking for. So the important thing here is that there is overtraining. You can get into the extents because you train your will so much, and this is why people can go to the gym 6 times a week, you know, and lift, and they overtrain, and then there is a detrimental effect in the body, contrary to what you actually want. See? I hope you can see the parallel here. So even though this trainee or Carla maybe strengthening their metaphysical will towards an activity and their commitment to it and their sacrifice to it, that's beautiful. However, it's having a detrimental effect in the body, precisely where we want it. Carla wanted more physical energy. Trainees want to have more, well, physical energy too, but the adaptations of it are being jeopardized. However, what's the clever way to do this? I'm talking about training, physical training here, and you can see how this applies to everything else. You can actually overtrain yourself, and that's okay, because that's a way to what we call overreaching. You get to a point in which you have exceeded the capacity that your body can tolerate, but then you follow it up with a week that is actually weak on training. So you lower your training to a volume of training that you can do where you just simply lift light weights, and quote unquote, I mean, compared to what you were doing. So what happens? Your body's going to supercompensate for this, and it's going to recover. And then the following week, you can go back and progressively start overreaching. Now, the details of this are not important, because that's all part of the periodization and programming that I love to do in the past. But the point is that you gradually overreach, then you have a week in which you overreach, like super, you exhaust yourself, but then comes a week of recovery. You do this, this is the smart way to do it. Somewhere in our will to whatever it is that we do, we should do this. What's the mechanism here? Is that you are exceeding that threshold slightly. You see, you want to be gentle with yourself, mentally and physically. You want to overreach that threshold so you can expand the capacity and then relax. You see? So that's how you train mentally and physically. To me, that's the clever way to do it. Now, what's Ra going to suggest for actually her training? Check it out. Ra says, oh, let me see. Did I go back too much? No. Okay. When the so-called aerobic. How did I not pronounce this? Well, yes, I used to be a trainer. When the so-called aerobic exercise is pursued, no less than 3 of your hours, and preferably 5 of your hours, should pass betwixt it and the swirling waters. When the walking has been accomplished, a period of no less than, we believe, 40 of your minutes must needs transpire before the swirling waters, and preferably twice that amount of your space-time. It is true that some greeting has encouraged the dizziness felt by the instrument. However, its source is largely the determination of the instrument to remain immersed in the swirling waters past the period of space-time. It may abide therein without exceeding its physical limits. Okay, so a couple of things here. Two different trainings. One is a little bit more intense than the other one, although I would call walking aerobic exercise as well, but I guess Carla was doing some sort of more high heart rate type of exercise, and so because of that she needed to have more time to relax the body before getting into the bathtub. If you see, they're saying 3 of your hours, no less than that, and preferably 5 hours. So she would do her exercise, wait 5 hours or so, and then go into the bathtub. That would be appropriate for her body. When walking, then she needed less time. In this case, 40 minutes, or maybe double. So an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and a half to wait, not 3 to 5 hours. So the more intense the exercise, this is for Carla, the more she needed to wait to get into the bathtub. And even though it is true that there is some mental energy that is being, that is affecting her body, that's the greeting that they're talking about, the mental greeting, psychic greeting. The source of this dizziness is largely the determination of Carla to remain for too long in the swirling waters, so in the bathtub. So not only the period of time, which I don't blame Carla for not knowing this, was maybe too short between exercise and the bathtub, but also the time that she was spending in the bathtub was too long. So that's one of the reasons. Or the main reason, Ra says. Okay, we move to more personal material. And actually, these two questions here, I think, speaking of versions of the Ra contact, these two questions were not included in the original books. They were not in book 4 nor in book 5. So these are the product of re-listening to the tapes, which Toby Wheelock, who is the one that hosts the website lawofone.info, lawofone.info, he is the one who re-listened all the tapes and found these questions. So you can say that these questions are only available in the re-listen version, which the Ra contact, the books have, by the way. So you would be able to read them in the books if you have them. But they're not in book 5, where these other questions were. Let's check it out. Don says in question 4, thank you, I feel obligated to ask the next somewhat transient question because of a request from Colonel Stevens. I also, for my own edification, would like to better understand the effect of the quarantine and first distortion. Would Rock comment on the purpose of the so-called Pleiades contact in Switzerland with Billy Meyer by an entity known as Simjasi or Simjas and others? I'm not sure how to pronounce that. So we can see, let me make a little thing here. We can see that for the first time in a long time, Don is going back to asking a question that we can already feel that is totally, I don't want to use the word primitive or beginner question, you know, that interest in quarantine and contact with others. But again, he was making a favor. He was doing a favor for his friend Billy Meyer, who apparently is a UFO researcher or something like that. I'm not sure who he is, but I heard that. And his name sounds sort of familiar too. In any case, you can see that Don is asking a question that goes a little bit outside of archetypical mind, the octave, evolution, the heart of seeking, and so on. All these things that speak more truly to our seeking, to our yearning for metaphysical and spiritual information. So let's see what Ra says here. So a contact with the Pleiades and something about the quarantine and the first distortion, free will. But all right, Ra says, it is not our practice to judge the value of a contact of metaphysical origin. We cannot confirm the contact referred to by the questionnaire as pure confederation contact. However, we might suggest that there is some positive material within the recorded transcript of converse during this contact, as we have spoken previously to the various characteristics of so-called mixed contact. We shall not repeat, but note that all communication is of the one infinite creator in its infinite distortions. Okay, so Billy Meyer was able to make contact with some Pleiades entities. There is information, and so Don is asking, I guess, something about the first distortion. Maybe the contact gave information about free will and the quarantine. I'm not sure what it is. So can Ra comment about this? Yes, they will say, one, it is not our custom to judge the value of other contacts. Like, that's not what we do. We're not here to tell you good or bad, great, not so great. That's somebody else talking. You know, it's like if you want to go to a teacher and then you ask the teacher, you know, what do you think this other person is talking about, this and that? I mean, I don't know. That's their way to say things, but use your discernment, right? That's what we would say. Same thing Ra is saying here. They cannot confirm, at least, that the contact or the information that they gave was by the Confederation. It wasn't pure Confederation, so something else was involved there. Just like I would say, you know, if somebody asks me about, which I get very often, especially in my teaching, about other things, you know, what do you think about this and that? I mean, I can only tell you that that is not related to the teaching. It doesn't mean that, you know, you should or shouldn't follow it. You do whatever you want. But for example, people, especially people in the past year, at least 3 or 4 people have talked to me about the Gateway Protocol or something like that. And, you know, that's great for people that want to explore their minds. Does it have anything to do with the teaching of self-realization? Not really. I mean, it's related to, because everything is related to this, but it's not deepening your knowledge of yourself. We can get very confused with that and explore so many things and the astral planes and the power of the mind and the psychic abilities and so on, but that's not related to finding the transformation that you're looking for, at least not in the direction of harmony. Could be related, maybe tangentially, like everything else is, but that's how things work. Now, they will suggest they're talking about, yes, there is some positive material in what they gave. Remember that mixed contact is that which comes with, I was taught this in a long time ago when I first got interested in these topics, that there is information that comes in like 90% positive, and then they inject a little bit of 10% negative. And that's what distorts everything and destroys basically the message itself. It starts to get distorted into a way that causes some sort of fear or defense or guilt, shame, victimhood, enemies, whatever. All of this. You can see this in many of the people who talk about these matters this way. I mean, does the raw content contain negative information? I actually think it does. I actually think that the material itself contains mixed contact. I don't think it's 100% raw. Now, what it is, you have to find out. You know, is it in the heart of seeking teaching? I don't think so. Could be, but I don't think so. Could it be more with the material of cattle mutilation and, you know, negative entities and the robots and things that they talked about at the beginning? Possibly. You know, there are things that just become sort of irrelevant when you read the raw material and you get into the mystical heart of it and you say, oh, this is the real stuff. Then you read the other one and say, okay, that's kind of irrelevant. You know, if there are so many superficial topics that were discussed here that have nothing to do with, you know, the direction which self-realization is, which again is the law of one. When you hear or read Ra talk about the law of one, that's what they're talking about. You become the creator. You become the peace and the harmony that the creator is and radiate that to others. It's what our mystical traditions have been saying and shining on us for thousands of years. So I don't consider anything more important than that. But I do understand that a lot of people study the material because they're interested in the phenomenal stuff that is in there. Egypt and the pyramids and what's behind the Sphinx. They don't talk about the Sphinx here, but you know, that kind of stuff, that's not for me, it's for other people, but that's fine. I would just say that of course is not, I wouldn't consider that positive material or negative, it's just irrelevant. That's my view though. Is it interesting to study the history and how things worked? Yeah, maybe. Does it help? No, Ra several times says, transit information, not so important. The heart of the seeking is here. The time of the pyramids is gone. Now the self is the thing to study and so on. But yeah. Okay, so that's my view. And that's what Ra is saying here. There's something else that they say. Mixed contact. However, even though they do say, this is a very important point, this is not to discredit the contact itself, but to actually emphasize and repeat that all communication is from the one infinite creator. In other words, everything that you perceive is not that you have to measure it as good or bad. I should not have read this or hear about this. I actually should have done. No, everything is there to inform you. And how can even stuff that is irrelevant can inform you into the right direction? That's up to you to discern. But everything is pointing in the same direction. You see, falsehood is pointing in the direction of truth, isn't it? You have to be exposed to falsehood to know what truth is. That's how you can discern it. So, yeah, everything has its value, I would say. Let's finish the personal material with the last question that we have here. Don says in question 5, is it all right for Colonel Stevens to receive the information that Ra just gave us? And Ra, like before, they say, we find this information to be confirmation of already perceived ideas, therefore permission is freely given. I think they would not have said anything if that was not the case, because they often say, we find that this information is for them to discern or for them to make up their minds. So, it was a given already that that information was there to share. They knew that this information was going to be put into books already. So they, it's just a confirmation that yes, it's fine. And often they say, or they repeat, that they find that they already know it. So all they're looking for is validation. There it is. They already know this. So they're just repeating stuff that they already know. But if there's something that they haven't figured out yet, then they would not risk giving an interpretation or an idea or a concept or a view that might skew their views. And that's why they sometimes say, we leave it to your consideration. Okay. Halfway through, we can go into a couple of questions. There's only one question that goes into transformation of the mind, which is the next one. And then we're going to begin to explore the Great Way, which is the last card in the tarot. Let's go to that. Long question here. Question 6. Don says, thank you. To continue with the tarot, I would like to make the additional observation with respect to card 6, that the male's arm being crossed, if the female to his right pulls on his left hand, it would cant. In effect, turn him, his entire body toward the right. And the same is true for the female on the left. Pulling on his right hand, she will turn his entire body to her side. Which is why my interpretation of what's meant by the tangle of the arms, that the transformation occurs by pull, which attempts to turn the entity toward the left or the right-hand path. Woodra comments on that observation. So, I talked about this in the last episode, and that was that the tangle is that the arms are crossed and he has both females on his side. The male representing the conscious mind, the females representing the unconscious mind. Like I said before, there are no two unconscious mind. Like, there is not a negative unconscious or a positive. You know, they're just one unconscious mind waiting to be selected by the conscious mind. So the conscious mind is actually either looking to the right or to the left. Ra's going to talk about this. But okay, so this is the depiction of the card, and it's showing a state in which the mind finds itself when it comes to transformation, to picking a path, to choosing. It's an aspect of what it's going to see in reality. This is a very important part, because this is when we are already exposed with the experience, or we have processed the experience, and now the transformation follows. Transformation is, okay, I am aware of both. So which one am I going to see? In which way am I going to direct my attention? Remember, conscious mind is attention, and of course, fashioning of experience through that perception, through that view, through that understanding. And so, well, what Don is saying here is that he says that whether, you know, one pulls or the other, the conscious mind is going to move in that direction because it's being pulled by it. But it's not like the conscious mind is being pulled. That would give free will to the unconscious mind. That's not how it works. And Ra's going to explain this, I think. So let's see. Ra says, we shall, meaning that they will comment on it. The concept of the pull towards mental polarity may well be examined in the light of what the student has already accreted concerning the nature of the conscious exemplified by the male and the unconscious exemplified by the female. Indeed, both the prostituted and the virginal of deep mind invite and await the reaching. If in this image of transformation of mind, then, each of the females points the way in which or the way it would go, but is not able to move, nor are the two female entities striving to do so. They are at rest. So the unconscious mind, in essence, is saying, let me put it this way. Right now, you are aware of a database that informs your reality. Let's call this view, okay? You have a worldview. That is your database. Because you're exposed to experience, like this one you're listening to me, you are presented with always a choice. Am I going to digest this information in terms of fear, separation, or am I going to digest this in terms of unity and peace, love, and so on? Now, that's up to you to discern. That database that is there, right, that is being stimulated by my words or the neighbor doing something or your family members, what have you, all these situations are catalysts that are coming to you. They are fashioning experience for you to pick and choose, of course, which way you're going to see things. So that database is one, but it's going to shape or take form in the way you perceive it. So your view is going to change depending on how you pick, how you select. And there are two ways to select. In one way, unity, in the other, separation. It's a very clumsy way to describe it, but that's the gist of it. And you see, the females represent rest. The unconscious awaits the conscious mind to give it its quality. So I like the virginal and prostituted image because prostitution means it's a sort of slavery. See, prostitution is actually like a bondage, and it's a product. You know, it's a product that is being used. This is different from, for example, I kind of became aware of this in terms of pornography, because we talk about pornography, porn. That's coming from prostitution, right? It's coming from prostitution. So does that mean that all sex that is depicted is pornography? Not at all, because there is another word that is more descriptive of what this illustration of sexuality could be. So you can see prostitution is the negative use of the unconscious mind for the act of sex. I'm talking about actual physical sex here. Whereas erotica has a different word. Sometimes they're used interchangeably to talk about erotic movies and so on. But erotica in its foundation means love, passionate love. Now that's different because there is no prostitution, you see? And the current state of course, the internet is that porn, for example, is everything. You can see the prostitution there, how it is depicted, whereas erotica could, if it's artistically created, it could depict the beauty of love, passionate love, physical sensuality, you see? And so there is a difference there. We're talking about the same thing, but it's our perception of it and how we depict it, how we illustrate it. So I leave that to your consideration, but think about those two things. The unconscious mind is, of course, the same thing. How do you perceive your unconscious mind? When you look at it with, you know, strife and anger and all these negative emotions, you're acting out of fear, and that is a potential polarization on the negative path. Now, the vast majority of people are not fully in agreement with that path, yet they depict those behaviors. They have that behavior with themselves, and that's why they feel completely in conflict with themselves. You see, let me put it this way. there's a lot of people who harbor these feelings towards themselves, but they project them outside. They say, well, you know, it's the government. Well, it's the people. Well, it's my family. Or it's always something external, right? But the conflict is with themselves. And as they depict and project themselves that way, they're acting with negative energy, with prostitution of the unconscious mind. That means that they can either follow it and polarize towards the negative. They can use that for their benefit or for the benefit of the ego. But the vast majority are positive people who don't want to have that. But they're unaware of them not being that. So they're identifying with something that they are not, and that's why they suffer. This is the basis of all suffering, I would say, because the vast majority of people do not feel compelled to follow the negative path. So that's something interesting there to consider. The positive one would be the one in which it goes into the beauty of things. How can I assimilate this? But that goes beyond the scope of this video. The point is that there is always a way in which we can examine the way we are reacting to reality, because that is the whole cycle of the mind, to react to reality and to fashion some sort of worldview. In Buddhism, the Eightfold Path starts, or at least I begin it with, right view. Right view is the knowledge of yourself. Once you know, once you have the power of knowledge of yourself, then all your thoughts should be informed by that, because you will see how your conditioned thoughts are not actually informed by that right view. You see, and if you change your thoughts, you change your expression and you change your actions, and the rest of your life, the cycle of the Eightfold Path, gets cleared. It crystallizes. But you have to start with right view. I'm going all over the place here, but once we talk about transformation of the mind, there's a lot to say. Let's go to the next paragraph. Ross says, the conscious entity holds both and will turn itself one way or the other, or potentially backwards and forwards, rocking first one way, then the other, and not achieving the transformation. In order for the transformation of mind to occur, one principle governing the use of the deep mind must be abandoned. So I just went on for like 10 minutes talking about this, and Ra describes it in a paragraph. The conscious mind, forget about the entity, the conscious mind is at that divergence point, right? Where it says, I can go in both ways, I need to pick one, right? Should I go left or right? I have to pick one. And in taking one way, it's like a Y, right? In taking one way, you have to abandon the other. But sometimes we can get really, you know, rocking back and forth, swiveling here and there, and saying, take two steps to the left, oh no, go back, go to the right, but oh my God, I am, you know, hesitation. Don't wobble, you know, whatever you do, don't wobble, just go with it and explore it. You know, you may get five steps into the negative and say, oh yes, this is definitely not for me. You go back and you go straight to the right. That's it. So that's what's happening. You see, the conscious entity is basically just, where do I go? In order for the transformation of the mind to occur, one principle governing the use of the deep mind must be abandoned. So that's what the card depicts. You have to abandon one way. You cannot hate and love the world at the same time. Otherwise, you're living in conflict with yourself. You know, it's like a hate-love relationship with your partner or even your dog. You know, you can have those relationships. That is representative of a conflicted mind, one that hasn't made the choice. Experience keeps coming, significator keeps being stimulated, the transformation does not happen. You have to pick, and to pick, you have to abandon one path. That's a good way to see it. You know, How do I know that I'm picking the right thing? Because I'm abandoning the other one. I'll give you a tip that it happens to me. It's not something that I do. It's something that happens to me in discernment. As I look at my mind, sometimes I see behaviors. It's like a very quiet app that is in the background running. And all of a sudden, I see how it's been, you know, choosing my thoughts. You know, it's been governing my thoughts in a way that I recognize, oh, those thoughts are not in accordance with my actual view, but they were there. As soon as I see them, I don't even have to do anything. I just need to become aware of them. And over time, it's like they start, they're still there. You know, they're still seducing me, you know, reminding me, like, you remember, you know, this is how we thought about reality. But you keep seeing the distance and say, no, I need to abandon this because it's not congruent, you know, the behavior, the thought, the way I speak, all of these things just aren't going away. So it's a good way to see it as you abandon one path. As soon as you do that, you move to the other one seamlessly. It doesn't require any effort, which is in line with what we do in my teaching. It makes all the sense in the world. It's not the doer. We're not the doers. We actually need to kill the doers to see how the doing is done. Next paragraph. This is the last one. Ross says, it is to be noted that the triangular shape formed by the shoulders and crossed elbows of consciousness is a shape to be associated with transformation. Indeed, you may see this shape echoed twice more in the image, each echo having its own riches to add to the impact of this complex of concepts. So, I don't have much to say here other than to point out the same thing, right? That there are a couple of triangles. There's even a love triangle if you think about it there. The conscious mind not knowing, I need to pick, but I have both. Oh, what do I do? I'm looking at the card right now. It has a triangle on the arrow, triangle on the bow. There's a lot of triangles there. Just look it up for yourself. I probably forgot to put it here. If I did, then kudos to me. Not very important, though. This is just Ross saying, well, take a look at the triangular shapes that are in the card, and each echo having its own riches to add to the impact of this complex of concepts. That's not for me to study, because I am not good at it, but I'm certain that a lot of people have, and good luck finding them, because I don't know them. And also, I'm not interested. Sounds terrible, right? Oh, Gabe's not interested in this. I'm not, actually. I'm more interested in the practical application of all of this, which we don't need to study, to be honest. Somebody told me one day, oh, you shouldn't say that because, you know, you're telling people that this is not necessary. Of course, she is a lot into the tarot, and she's a friend. There's nothing, no conflict there. And, you know, to a degree, she's right. But I'm just saying my piece, you know. I'm not telling people not to study things. That's just the way I see the world. I'm not interested in, you know, certain studies. I'm more interested in other stuff. Does that make it less important? Not at all. We ascribe importance to whatever we want. Okay, let's take a look at the next question. Let's leave a teaser because we have time. Yes, let's leave a teaser for the next episode. This is going to be the great way. Question 7. Don says, thank you. We will probably return to this card next session for more of an observation after we study Ra's comments to conserve and efficiently use the time. At this time, I will make some notes with respect to card 7. Spoiler alert. Next session, they don't talk about it. Don says, and finally asks, First, the veil between the conscious and the unconscious mind has been removed. This is in card 7. The veil is the curtain, I would assume, at the top, which is lifted. Even though this veil has been removed, perception of intelligent infinity is still distorted according to the seeker's beliefs and means of seeking. Would Ra comment on that? So, again, if I remember, I'll put the card here, but you can go check it out with more time and just take a good look at it. There is a veil on the top where Don makes the suggestion that there is, it's partially lifted and so on. So can Ra comment on that? They're going to say, of course, yes, and they're going to talk about it, a couple of paragraphs. But yeah, that's basically the question that Don is making. That the veil between the conscious and the unconscious mind has been removed. I don't think it is removed. Like, the Great Way doesn't remove the veil. Yet it does work, obviously, with some permeation of the veil. And we'll see what Ra says. But yeah, I don't think you don't lift the veil. I actually answered a question recently in one of the seminars that somebody asked about us removing the veil completely when we awaken. That's not the case. We begin to see through the veil. That's a different thing. But the veil is not removed. Not to my understanding. Not the way I see it. Last note that I would say about this session is that from here on, the sessions begin to be spaced out by weeks, even months in between. So I'll make a mention of this if I remember next session. This is interesting, just because it's interesting. All right, let's see what Ra says. They say, as one observes the veil of the image of the Great Way of Mind, it may be helpful to ideate using the framework of environment. The Great Way of Mind, body, or spirit is intended to limn the milieu within which the work of mind, body, or spirit shall be placed. Thusly, the veil is shown both somewhat lifted and still present, since the work of mind and its transformation involves progressive lifting of the great veil betwixt conscious and deep mind. The complete success of this attempt is not properly a portion of third density work, and more especially third density mental processes. So yes, I was half right. Not even half right, it's not even correct. It's just that my depiction of it is similar, and I'll expand on it. Couple of things. Limb seems to mean depiction through illustration, and milieu, surroundings. I learned these words here, by the way. Don't think these were part of my vocabulary in the past. So the great way of mind, body, and spirit, so all the cards in the archetypical mind that are about great way of these three cycles, they are sort of delineating the environment in which the work is placed, or the work of either mind, body, or spirit is going to happen. Interesting for the rest of the understanding of the other great ways, right? However, the part that is important here is that in the Great Way of Mind, Ra says that the veil is shown somewhat lifted, but still present. Yeah, so you don't remove it. It's just, instead of lifting the veil, I like to say that the permeability becomes greater. And I'll talk more about this. Since the work of mind and its transformation involves progressive lifting of the great veil between conscious and deep mind, the complete success of this attempt is not a portion of third density work. So you don't do this as a human. You will never do it, right? And more especially third density mental processes. So more specific. Okay, so my view, the way I see it here depicted is that you lift the veil and you kind of see more and more as you lift it. But that, in a way, gives me the impression that I'm lifting the veil, and then there is no veil between that which I am looking at and me. There is no veil. Now, I think it's a little bit more illustrative to look at the veil as a thickness, right? Like fog, or like a veil that women in the past used to wear, which it would veil their face. But imagine that the pores that make up the veil start expanding. Now, I like this vision more because it's aligned with what Don and Ra had talked about, the veil, which is permeability. The veil is semi-permeable, says Ra, and the way I see it is the more we get in touch with our true self, the more these pores amplify, they expand. And so even though we never remove the veil, we see more clearly through the veil. That is the work of polarization. Now, I think it's interesting to maintain the idea of the veil to give more credence to the fact that there are negative beings who use the veil for intensifying the idea of separation. So in essence, I can't make a full analogy here, but they are using the veil to benefit their view that there is separation, and more specifically that they are the ones separated from everybody else. Hence, for them to evolve, they need to control more of the universe, because there is a primal desire, which is to unify all things. So the negatives do it through a progression, a futile progression of dominating more and more and more, until they realize that if I am able to dominate everything, then wouldn't I be all? So for me to dominate everything, I have to become everything. And so they learned the lesson too late. Not too late, but at the later stages of evolution. So you see, everything is perfectly balanced. Oh, it's a beautiful model, I have to say. I appreciate it. I love this model. But yeah, those are my two cents here. Conclusions. Well, let's go back to the transformation of mind, which is where we spent most of our time, or the question that we spend more time on. It's about knowing, you see, because doubt comes from not fully knowing. Yes, I mean, I know, I heard myself and it sounds so redundant, what I just said. But it's true. Just go back to the simplicity of it. If there are doubts, then it means that you don't know. And yet, there is a doubt in terms of what to do. You're presented with options. So it's not like you're not fully knowledgeable of the situation. It's just that you don't know which is the appropriate way. In many cases, we don't even know the possibility of options. So we just say, oh, that's how I am, you know. And yes, that's how the world is. The world is suffering. The world is misery. And you can't have both. The thing is that we don't know that we can't have both. You know, it's like, I love you, but to love you, I need to hate you too. Nobody in their own right mind would agree to a relationship like that. Nobody would say, yes, that's the perfect relationship. I'm looking for somebody who loves and hates me at the same time. It makes no sense. And yet we have this relationship with the world and ourselves. So we first need to come out of that delusion that's how the world ought to be, because hey, we live in a duality world, you know, so we need to be fine with both. No, that's not true. Duality is a perception that allows for the experience of both things, but it's not the true way of looking at the world. That is not the truth. You don't live in a world of duality. You live in a world of perceptions through which duality is only capable of depicting it, but your reality is not two. Your reality is one. And if you make contact, if you get in touch with that, then you're able to see and discern whenever this conflict of dual love and hate can be resolved, only by going into what in Buddhism we call the middle way, or just simply abiding in the presence of the Creator. The Creator cannot have a polarized view, otherwise it wouldn't create anything. It would have to be unpolarized, not two. That is the way. Whether you like it or not, that is the way. That's just the law of one. Okay, so we come to the end of this first part, right on the hour. Perfect. Love it. We have more to cover in terms of the Great Way. We're going to explore that more in this session. Like I said, we have only one more session that has material relevant to the archetypical mind. This is the moment where I promote myself. Oh, actually, let me promote my friend, Colby. Have I said it enough? Dream State Logic. It's the music you're listening in the background. I love this man. He makes beautiful music. And you can check his content down here. If I remember, I'll actually leave a link if you want to buy one of his t-shirts. I think they have a beautiful design. I love the connection that he has with universe and technology and the spiritual path. It's just beautiful. I love Colby. If you're listening to this, brother, thank you so much for doing what you do. So go check out his music, and if you want merchandise, shirts beautiful like this, go check it out. It's my friend. Also, my services. So I am on Telegram now. Not many people have joined. I would like to see more people, but that's okay. Whoever we have there, I'm actually doing seminars. I'm going to continue doing investigations into the nature of our being, which is the practical aspect of this teaching, which is what I do. If you're interested in mentoring with me, contact me on Instagram. Description always has the links. Go on Instagram, send me a message and say, hey, I'm interested in what you teach. Tell me more about it. And we'll chat. We'll talk about it. Yeah, we'll have a good time and explore this together. So that's all I got. Thank you so much now for listening, for being part of this 100 sessions, which is celebrate this way. I'm not this in some way, but I don't know how. And we have, yeah, 6 more sessions after this. Have a good day or good night, whatever you are. Be at peace, my friend. And I'll catch you on part 2 of session 100.